We maintain several breweries and storehouses for small beer. It's a sideline, a sort of hobby for some of our blending masters. Our beer is stored in casks, and the location of these warehouses is public knowledge. Slowly, carefully, while Grau and I sailed south, my masters have been moving casks of Osterschalin brandy to the beer warehouses and relabeling them. They will continue to do so while we prepare here, and until our ships appear in the harbor of Emberlane.
So you won't be loading brandy in secret?
Doña Sofia clapped her hands together.
As far as anyone knows, you'll be loading beer in the open.
Exactly, my lady. Even the large export of beer won't be anywhere near as suspicious as a movement of the unaged brandy. It'll be looked on as a commercial coup. We'll be the first to dodge the interdict on Emberlane-flagged vessels. We'll bring in a pile of supplies for the coming siege and a fine apparent profit for ourselves. Then, once we've got all the brandy loaded, we'll put out to sea, bringing 60 or 70 Bell Oster family and employees to form the nucleus of our new business operations in Camorre. Discovery after that will be immaterial.
All of this to be thrown together on short notice.
Don Lorenzo was deep in thought. 15,000 crowns, I'd say. Perhaps 20. I concur, my lord. Count on an additional 5,000 or so for bribes and other arrangements.
Locke shrugged.
Certain men are going to have to look the other way for us to do our job when we reach Emberlane, warehouse ruse or no.
25,000 crowns, then.
Damn. Lorenzo downed the last of the brandy in his glass, set it down, and folded his hands together on the table before him.
You're asking me for more than half of my fortune.
I like you, Lucas, but now it's time to discuss the other side of the proposal.
Of course.
Lucas stopped to offer the Don another dash of the counterfeit unaged. The Don began to wave him off, but his taste buds prevailed over his better judgment, and he held out his glass. Doña Sofia did so as well, and Jean hurried over to pass her glass between her and Locke. When he'd served the Salvaras, Locke poured a companionably large amount into his own snifter.
First, you have to understand what the House of Bell Oster is and is not offering.
You will never have the Osterschalen process. It will continue to be passed down verbally and strictly within the house. We can afford you no properties as collateral or in payment. We expect to forfeit them upon fleeing Emberlane. Resecuring the vineyards at a future date is our own problem. Any effort on your part to pry into the Osterschalin process, to suborn any Bell Oster men or women, will be regarded as an absolute breach of trust.
Locke sipped brandy.
I have no idea what specific penalties we could levy to express our displeasure, but it would be fully expressed. I am instructed to be entirely clear on this point.
And so you are.
Doña Sofia placed one hand on her husband's left shoulder.
But these limitations are not yet an offer.
Forgive me, gracious Doña Sofia, for speaking to you like this, but you must understand, this is the most important thing the House of Bell Oster has ever contemplated. Grau and I hold the future of our combine in our rather vulnerable hands. At this moment, I can't speak to you just as your luncheon guest, Lucas Fairwhite. I am the House of Bell Oster. You have to understand that some things are not on the table, not even by the most remote implication.
The Salvaras nodded as one, Sophia just a bit more slowly than Lorenzo.
Now, consider the situation. War is coming to Emberlane. Our vineyards and our properties are as good as lost. And without those vineyards, there will be no Osterschalin actually produced for only the Marrows know how long. 10 years? A generation? Even when we have the vineyards back, the soil will need years to recover. This is the way it has been 3 times before. For many, many years to come, the only new Osterschalin available is going to come from whatever portion of those 6,000 casks we can move out of Emberlane, like thieves in the night. Imagine the demand. The price escalation.
The Don's lips moved unconsciously as he calculated. Doña Sofia stared off into the distance, her brow furrowed.
Osterschalin brandy was the finest and most sought-after liquor known. Even the alchemical wines of Tal Varrar, in 100 bewitching varieties, were not as expensive. A single half-gallon bottle of the youngest available Osterschalin was 30 full crowns at retail. The price went up sharply with age. With a surprise shortage, a fixed supply, and no new crop of Osterschalin grapes in sight?
Fuck them!
Said Conte, totally unable to help himself when the sums involved vanished over his mental horizon.
Beg pardon, Doña Sofia.
You should.
She drained her snifter in one quick, unladylike gulp.
Your calculations are off. This merits a triple fuck damn at least.
The House of Bel Oster, Locke continued, wishes to establish a partnership with you, based in Camor, to store and market Osterschalin brandy during our interregnum. In exchange for your assistance in transporting it from Emberlane in our moment of extreme need, we are prepared to offer you 50% of the proceeds from the sale of anything you transport for us. Again, consider the situation and the price of Osterschalin during a shortage. You could recoup your initial investment 10 times over in the first year. Give us 5 years, or 10.
Yes, Don Lorenzo fiddled with his optics. But Lucas, somehow, sitting here discussing the possible destruction of your house and the move to a city 500,000 miles to the south, you don't sound entirely displeased.
Locke used a particularly endearing wry smile he'd once practiced before a mirror glass for weeks.
When my masters grasped the essence of their current situation, some of them suggested we should have engineered an artificial shortage years ago. As it is, we are determined that we can turn a painful setback into a glorious return. Those 6,000 casks, sold at shortage prices over a number of years, we could return to Emberlane with a fortune that eclipses everything we'd be leaving behind. And as for your own situation,
we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of crowns. Doña Sofia returned from her thoughtful trance. We're talking about millions, even split between us.
It would be foolish to presume too much, but yes, there is the possibility that the sums involved could reach such figures. My masters are also prepared to grant one final compensation upon our successful return to Emberlane and the restoration of the Osterschalin vineyards. We offer your family a permanent stake in all Bel Oster operations thereafter. Certainly nothing close to a controlling interest, but something respectable. A 10 to 15% share. You would be the first, and, we hope, the only foreigners ever offered such an interest.
There was a brief pause.
That's a very attractive offer, Don Salvara said at last. And to think all this was going to fall into Jacobo's lap simply by default. By the gods, Lucas, if we ever cross paths with those thieves again, I'm going to thank them for arranging our introduction.
Well, Locke chuckled. I, for my part, can let bygones be bygones. Grauman might feel somewhat differently. And the fact remains that while I sense we may be shaking hands very soon, we still have to assemble our ships, sail north to Emberlane, and snatch up our prize. The situation is like a damaged cargo rope, unravelling down to a single thread.
He saluted the Salvaras with his brandy snifter.
It will snap.
Out on the water, The devilfish was victorious, and the guards rewarded it for its service by filling it with poisoned crossbow bolts. Boat hooks and chains were used to haul the carcass out of the center of the shifting revel. There was just no putting a creature like that back into the box once it had served its purpose. The monster's red blood mixed with that of its victims and slowly settled in a broad, dark cloud. Even this had a deliberate part to play in what was to come next. 5. Scholars of the Therin Collegium, from their comfortable position well inland, could tell you that the wolf sharks of the Iron Sea are beautiful and fascinating creatures, their bodies more packed with muscle than any bull, their abrasive hide streaked with every color from old copper green to storm cloud black. Anyone actually working the waterfront in Camor and on the nearby coast could tell you that wolf sharks are big, aggressive bastards that like to jump. Carefully caged, starved, and maddened by blood, wolf sharks are the key to the customary highlight of the shifting revel. Other cities have gladiatorial games. Other cities pit men against animals. But only in Camor can you see a specially armed gladiator, a contrarrechiala, battle a live, leaping shark. And in Camor, only women are allowed by tradition to be contrarrechiala. This is the teeth show. 6. Locke couldn't tell if the four women were truly beautiful, but they were undeniably striking. They were all dark-skinned Camori with muscles like farm girls, imposing even at a distance, and they wore next to nothing, tight black cotton shifts across their chests, wrestlers' loincloths, and thin leather gloves. Their black hair was pulled back under the traditional red bandanas and threaded with brass and silver bangles that caught the sunlight in chains of white flashes. The purpose of these bangles was a matter of argument. Some claimed that they confused the poor eyesight of the sharks, while just as many claimed that their glare helped the monsters better sight their prey. Each contrarrechiala carried two weapons, a short javelin in one hand and a special axe in the other. These axes had grips enclosed by full hand guards, making them difficult to lose. They were double-headed, with the expected curved blade on one side and a long, sturdy pickhead on the other. A skilled fighter usually tried to slash a shark's fins and tail to nothing before making a kill. Few but the very best could kill with anything but the spike. Wolf shark skin could be like tree bark. Locke stared at the grim women and felt his usual melancholy admiration. They were, to his eyes, as mad as they were courageous.
"I know that's Cecilia de Ricura there on the far left."
Don Lorenzo was pointing the women out for Lucas Fairwright's benefit, taking a break from more than an hour of rapid negotiations.
"She's decent, and beside her is Agnesa, who carries her javelin but never ever uses it. The other two, well, they must be new, at least new to the revel."
"It's so unfortunate," said the Doña, "that the Barangius sisters aren't out there today, Master Fairwhite. They're the best."
"Probably the best there ever has been."
Don Salvara squinted to cut some of the glare rising off the water, and tried to estimate the size of the sharks, barely visible as shadows within their cages.
"Or ever will be. But they haven't been at the revel for the past few months."
Locke nodded and chewed on the inside of one of his cheeks. As Locke Lamora, garista of the Gentleman Bastards, and respectable sneak thief, he knew the Barangius twins personally. He also knew exactly where they'd been for those past few months. Out on the water, the first fighter was taking her position. Contrarrechiala fought across a series of stepping-stone platforms, each about 2 feet wide and raised half a foot off the water. These platforms were set out in a square grid, 4 or 5 feet apart, leaving plenty of room for the opposition to swim between them. The women would have to hop between these platforms at a rapid pace to strike out at the sharks, while dodging leaps in return. A slip into the water was usually the end of the contest. Beyond the line of shark cages, opened by chain pulleys connected to a barge well beyond the periphery of any possible shark activity, there was a little boat, crewed by extremely well-paid volunteer rowers, and carrying the three traditional observers of any teeth show. First, there was a priest of Yono, in his sea-green robes fringed with silver. Beside him, there was a black-robed, silver-masked priestess of Azaguiya, Lady of the Long Silence, Goddess of Death. Lastly, there was a physicker, whose presence had always struck Locke as an extremely optimistic gesture.
"Come on!"
The young woman, apparently Cecilia de Ricura, raised her weapons into the air over her head. The heavy murmur of the crowd subsided, leaving only the noise of water lapping against boats and breakwaters. 15,000 watchers held their collective breath.
"I dedicate this death to Duke Nicovante, our lord and patron!"
Such was the traditional phrasing of the Contrarecala's salute. This death could conveniently refer to either participant in the battle. With a great flourish of trumpets and the cheer of the crowd, the boatmen outside the circle of cages loosed the afternoon's first shark. The 10-foot fish, already blood-mad, shot forth from imprisonment and began to circle the stepping platforms, its ominous grey fins slicing a ripple line in the water. Cecilia balanced on one foot and bent down to slap the water with the heel of the other, screaming oaths and challenges. The shark took the bait. In a few seconds, it was in amongst the platforms, stocky body whipping back and forth like a toothy pendulum.
"This one doesn't like to waste time!"
Don Salvara actually wrung his hands together.
"I bet it's an early leaper!"
Barely had these words escaped his mouth than the shark rocketed up out of the water in a fountain of silver spray, hurling itself at the crouching fighter. The shark's leap was not a high one. Cecilia avoided it by jumping right to the next platform over. In midair, she let her javelin go with a backhanded cast. The shaft sunk into the shark's flank and quivered there for a split second before the streamlined mass of hungry muscles splashed back down into the water. Crowd reaction was mixed. The cast had displayed remarkable agility but minimal power. Cecilia's shark was likely only further angered and her javelin wasted.
"Oh, poor decision," the Donya clicked her tongue. "This girl needs to learn some patience. We'll see if her new friend gives her the chance."
Thrashing, spraying pink-foamed water, the shark maneuvered for another attack, chasing Cecilia's shadow on the water. She hopped from platform to platform, axe reversed so the spike was facing outward.
"Master Fairwhite."
Don Lorenzo removed his optics and played with them while he watched the fight. Apparently, they weren't necessary for use at long distances.
"I can accept your terms, but you have to appreciate that my portion of the initial risk is quite heavy, especially relative to my total available funds. My request, therefore, is that the split of revenues from our Ostershalin sales be adjusted to 55-45 in my favor."
Locke pretended to ponder while Cecilia pumped her arms and leapt for dear life, the eager grey fin slashing through the water just behind her feet.
"I'm authorized to make such a concession on behalf of my masters. In return, I would fix your family's ownership interest in the resecured Ostershalin vineyards at 5%.
"Done,"
the Don smiled.
"I will fund 2 large galleons, crew and officers, necessary bribes and arrangements, and a cargo to take north with us. I'll oversee 1 galleon, you the other. Mercenary crews of my choosing to be placed aboard each vessel for added security. Conte will travel with you. Your Grauman can stay at my side. Any expenditures that bring our budget over 25,000 Komori crowns are to be made solely at my discretion."
The shark leapt and missed again. Cecilia performed a brief one-armed handstand on her platform, waving her axe. The audience roared while the shark rolled over gracelessly in the water and came back for another pass.
Agreed, said Locke. Signed identical copies of our contract to be kept by each of us. One additional copy in Therin to be kept with a mutually agreeable neutral solicitor, to be opened and examined by them within the month should one of us have an accident while fetching the casks. One additional copy in Vadran to be signed and placed into the care of an agent known to me for eventual delivery to my masters. I shall require a bonded scribe at the Tumble home this evening, and a promissory note for 5,000 crowns to be drawn at Maraggio's tomorrow, so I can get to work immediately.
And that is all that remains?
Quite everything, said Locke. The Don was silent for several seconds.
The hell with it, I agree. Let's clasp hands and take our chances.
Out on the water, Cecilia paused and hefted her axe, timing a blow as the shark approached her platform on her right, undulating, moving too slow for a high leap. Just as Cecilia shifted her weight to bring the spike down, the shark jackknifed in the water beside her, squeezing its body into a U-shape, and drove itself straight downward. This maneuver flicked its tail into the air, catching the Contrarechiala just under her knees. Screaming more in shock than in pain, Cecilia de Ricura fell backward into the water. It was all over a few seconds after that. The shark came up biting and must have taken her by one or both legs. They turned over and over in the water a few times. Locke caught glimpses of the frantic woman's form alternating with the dark, rough hide of the shark. White, then grey, white, then grey. In moments the pink foam was dark red once more, and the two struggling shadows were sinking into the depths beneath the platforms. Half the crowd roared lusty approval. The rest bowed their heads in a respectful silence that would last just until the next young woman entered the ring of red water.
Gods!
Doña Sofia stared at the spreading stain on the water. The surviving fighters stood with their heads lowered, and the priests were gesturing some sort of mutual blessing.
Unbelievable! Taken in so fast by such a simple trick!
Well, my father used to say that one moment of misjudgment at the revel is worth 10 at any other time. Locke bowed deeply to her, taking one hand and kissing it.
I doubt him not at all, Doña Sofia, not at all.
Smiling amiably, he bowed to her once more, then turned to shake hands with her husband.
Interlude. Locke stays for dinner. 1.
What?
Locke nearly jumped to his feet.
What are you talking about?
My boy, said Chains, my intermittently brilliant little boy. Your world has such small horizons. You can see clearly enough to pull a fast one on someone, but you can't see past the immediate consequences. Until you learn to think ahead of the repercussions, you are putting yourself and everyone around you in danger. You can't help being young, but it's past time that you stopped being stupid, so listen carefully. Your first mistake was that taking coin from the watch isn't a beating offence. It's a killing offence. Are we clear on that? Here in Camor, the watch takes our coin, and never the other way around. This rule is set in stone, and there are no exceptions, no matter what kind of thief you are. It's death. It's a throat-slashing, shark-feeding, off-to-meet-the-gods offence. Clear? Locke nodded. So when you set Veslin up, you really set him up. But you compounded this mistake when you used a white iron coin. You know how much a full crown is worth, exactly?
Lots.
Ah, lots isn't exactly. You don't speak Therin, or you don't really know.
I guess I don't really know.
Well, if everything's butter and nobody's been shaving the damn things, that little piece of shiny white iron was worth 40 silver solons. You see? 240 coppers.
Your eyes are wide. That means you can think that big. That you understand?
Yes. Wow.
Yes. Wow. Let me put it in perspective. A yellow jacket, one of our selfless and infinitely dutiful city watchmen, might make that much for 2 months of daily duty. And watchmen are decently paid for common folk, and they sure as blessed shit do not get paid in white iron. Eh? So not only was Veslin taking money, he was taking too much money. A full crown. You can buy a death for much less, yours included.
How much did you pay for my...
Locke tapped his chest, where the death mark still hung beneath his shirt. I don't mean to prick your rather substantial opinion of yourself, but I'm still not sure if it was 2 coppers wisely spent. At the boy's expression, Chains barked out a rich, genuine laugh, but then his voice grew serious once again. Keep guessing, boy. But the point remains. You can get good, hard men to do serious work for less. You could buy 5 or 6 major pieces of business, if you know what I mean. So when you stuck a white iron coin in Veslin's things...
It was too much money for anything... simple?
Dead on. Far too much money for information or errands. Nobody in their right mind gives a fucking graveyard urchin a full crown. Unless that urchin is being paid to do something big. Kill your old master, for example. Smoke out all of Shades Hill and everyone in it. So if the poor thief-maker was upset to discover that Veslin was on the take, you can imagine how he felt when he saw how much money was involved. Locke nodded furiously. Ah, so. 2 mistakes. Your 3rd mistake was involving Gregor. Was Gregor supposed to get hit with the ugly stick?
I didn't like him, but no. I just wanted Veslin. Maybe I wanted Gregor to get a little, but not as much as Veslin.
Just so. You had a target, and you had a twist to play on that target, but you didn't control the situation. So your game for Veslin spilled over, and Gregor Foss got the knife too.
That's what I said, isn't it? I already admitted it.
Angry now? My, yes, you would be. Angry that you fucked up. Angry that you're not as clever as you think. Angry that the gods gave lots of other people the same sort of brain they gave Locke Lamora. Quite the pisser, isn't it? Locke blew his little lamp out with 1 quick breath, then flung it in an arc, as high over the parapet as his slender arm could throw. The crash of its landing was lost in the murmur of the busy Camorri night. The boy crossed his arms defensively.
Well, it certainly is nice to be free from the threat of that lamp, my boy.
Chains drew a last breath of smoke, then rubbed his dwindling sheaf of tobacco out against the roof stones.
Was it informing for the Duke, plotting to murder us?
Locke said nothing. Teeth clenched and lower lip protruding. Petulance, the natural non-verbal language of the very young. Chains snorted.
I do believe everything you've told me, Locke, because I had a long talk with your former master before I took you off his hands. Like I said, he told me everything. He told me about your last and biggest mistake, the one that tipped him off and got you sent here. Can you guess what it might have been?
Locke shook his head.
Can't or won't?
I really don't know.
Locke looked down. I hadn't actually thought about it.
You showed other kids in streets the white iron coin, didn't you? You had them help you look for it. You let some of them know what it might be used for, and you ordered them not to talk about it. But what did you, back that order up with?
Locke's eyes widened. His pout returned, but his petulance evaporated.
They hated Veslin, too. They wanted to see him get it. Of course. Maybe that was enough for one day. But what about later? After Veslin was dead, and Gregor was dead, and your master had had a chance to cool down some and reflect on the situation? What if he started asking questions about a certain Lamora boy? What if he took some of your little boon companions from streets and asked them nicely if Locke Lamora had been up to anything unusual, even for him? Oh, the boy winced. Oh. Oh, ho, ho! Chains reached out and slapped the boy on the shoulder. Enlightenment! When it comes like a brick to the head, doesn't it? I guess. So, said Chains, now you see where everything went wrong. How many boys and girls are in that little hill, Locke? 100? 120? More? How many do you really think your old master could handle if they turned on him? 1 or 2, no problem, but 4? 8? All of them? I guess we never thought about it. Because he doesn't rule his graveyard by logic, boy. He rules it by fear. Fear of him keeps the older sprats in line. Fear of them keeps little shits like you in line. Anything that undermines that fear is a threat to his position. Enter Locke Lamora, waving the idiot flag and thinking himself so much cleverer than the rest of the world.
I don't think I'm cleverer than the rest of the world.
You did until 3 minutes ago. Listen, I'm a garista. It means I run a gang, even if it's just a small one. Your old master is a garista too. The garista of Shades Hill. And when you mess with a leader's ability to rule his gang, out come the knives. How long do you think the thief-maker could control Shades Hill if word got around of how you played him so sweetly? How you jerked him around like a kitten on a chain? He would never have real control over his orphans ever again. They'd push and push until it finally came to blood.
And that's why he got rid of me? But what about streets? What about the ones that helped me get Veslin?
Good questions. Easily answered. Your old master takes orphans in off the streets and keeps them for a few years. Usually he's through with them by the time they're 12 or 13. He teaches them the basics. How to sneak, thief, and speak the cant and mix with the right people. How to get along in a gang and how to dodge the noose. When he's through with them, he sells them to the bigger gangs, the real gangs. You see? He takes orders. Maybe the Grey Faces need a second-story girl. Maybe the Arsenal boys want a mean little bruiser. It's a great advantage to the gangs. It brings them suitable new recruits that don't need to have their hands held.
That I know. That's why he sold me to you.
Yes, because you're a very special case. You have profitable skills, even if your aim so far has been terrible. But your little friends in streets, did they have your gifts? They were just regular little coat charmers, simple little teasers. They weren't ripe. Nobody would give a penny for them except slavers, and your old master has one sad old scrap of real conscience. He wouldn't sell one of you to the crimpers for all the coin in Camor.
So what you're saying is he had to do something to all of us that knew about the coin, all of us that could figure it out or tell about it, and I was the only one he could sell.
Correct. And as for the others, well, Chains shrugged. It'll be quick. 2-3 weeks from now, nobody'll even remember their names. You know how it goes in the hill.
I got them killed?
Yes. Chains didn't soften his voice. You really did.
As surely as you tried to hurt Veslin, you killed Gregor and 4 or 5 of your little comrades into the bargain.
Shit!
Do you see now what consequences really are? Why you have to move slowly, think ahead, control the situation? Why you need to settle down and wait for time to give you sense to match your talent for mischief? We have years to work together, Locke. Years for you and my other little hellions to practice quietly. And that has to be the rule if you want to stay here. No games, no cons, no scams, no anything except when and where I tell you. When someone like you pushes the world pushes back. Other people are likely to get hurt. Am I clear? Locke nodded. Now. Chain snapped his shoulders back and rolled his head from side to side. There was a series of snaps and cracks from somewhere inside him. Ah. Do you know what a death offering is?
No.
It's something we do for the benefactor. Not just those of us who are initiates of the 13th. Something all of us crooks do for one another. All the right people of Camor. When we lose someone we care about, we get something valuable and we throw it away. For real, you understand. Into the sea, into a fire, something like that. We do this to help our friends on their way to what comes next. Clear so far?
Yeah, but my old master...
Oh, he does it, trust me. He's a wretched miser, and he always does it in private, but he does it for each and every one of you he loses. Figures he wouldn't tell you about it, but here's the thing. There's a rule that has to be followed with the offering. It can't be given willingly, you understand? It can't be something you already have. It has to be something you go out and steal from someone else, special, without their permission or their, complicity. Get me? It has to be genuine theft.
Sure.
Father Chains cracked his knuckles. You're going to make a death offering for every single boy or girl you got killed, Locke. One for Veslin, one for Gregor, one for each of your little friends in streets. I'm sure I'll know the count in just a day or two.
But I... they weren't...
Of course they were your friends, Locke. They were your very good friends. Because they're going to teach you that when you kill someone, there are consequences. It is one thing to kill in a duel, to kill in self-defense, to kill for vengeance. It is another thing entirely to kill simply because you are careless. Those deaths are going to hang over your head until you're so careful you make the saints of Perelandro weep. Your death offering will be 1,000 full crowns per head. All of it properly stolen by your own hand.
But I... What? 1,000 crowns? Each? 1,000?
You can take that death mark off your neck when you offer up the last coin of it, and not a moment sooner.
But that's impossible! It'll take forever!
It'll take years, but we're thieves, not murderers, here in my temple. And the price of your life with me is that you must show respect for the dead. Those boys and girls are your victims, Locke. Get that through your head. This is something you owe them before the gods, something you must swear to by blood before you can stay. Are you willing to do so? Locke seemed to think for a few seconds. Then he shook his head as though to clear it, and nodded. Then hold out your left hand. As Locke did so, Chains produced a slender, blackened steel stiletto from within his robe, and drew it across his own left palm. Then, holding Locke's outstretched hand firmly, he scratched a shallow, stinging cut between the boy's thumb and index finger. They shook hands firmly until their palms were thick with mingled blood. "Then you're a gentleman bastard, like the rest of us. I'm your garista, and you're my pezon, my little soldier. I have your oath in blood to do what I've told you to do, to make the offerings for the souls of the people you've wronged."
"I'll do it," Locke said.
"Good. That means you can stay for dinner. Let's get down off this roof."
2. Behind the curtained door at the rear of the sanctuary, there was a grimy hall leading to several grimy rooms. Moisture and mould and poverty were on abundant display. There were cells with sleeping pallets, lit by oiled paper lamps that gave off a light the colour of cheap ale. Scrolls and bound books were scattered on the pallets. Robes in questionable states of cleanliness hung from wall hooks.
"This is unnecessary nonsense." Chains gestured to and fro as he led Locke into the room closest to the curtained door, as though showing off a palace. "Occasionally we play host to a tutor or a travelling priest of Perelandro's order, and they have to see what they expect."
Chain's own sleeping pallet, for Locke saw that the wall manacles in the other room could surely reach none of the other sleeping chambers back here, was set atop a block of solid stone, a sort of heavy shelf jutting from the wall. Chains reached under the stale blankets, turned something that made a metallic clacking noise, and lifted his bed up as though it were a coffin lid. The blankets turned out to be on some sort of wooden panel with hinges set into the stone. An inviting golden light spilled from within the stone block, along with the spicy smells of high-class Kamori cooking. Locke knew that aroma only from the way it drifted out of the Alchigrante district or down from certain inns and houses.
"In you go!"
Chains gestured once again, and Locke peeked over the lip of the stone block. A sturdy wooden ladder led down a square shaft, just slightly wider than Chains' shoulders. It ended about 20 feet below, on a polished wood floor.
"Don't gawk! Climb!"
Locke obeyed. The rungs of the ladder were wide and rough and very narrowly spaced. He had no trouble moving down it, and when he stepped off, he was in a tall passage that might have been torn out of the Duke's own tower. The floor was indeed polished wood, long, straight golden-brown boards that creaked pleasantly beneath his feet. The arched ceiling and the walls were entirely covered with a thick, milky golden glass that shone faintly, like a rainy-season sun peeking out from behind heavy clouds. The illumination came from everywhere and nowhere. The walls scintillated. With a series of thumps and grunts and jingles, for Locke saw that he now carried the day's donated coins in a small burlap sack, Chains came down and hopped to the floor beside him. He gave a quick tug to a rope tied to the ladder, and the false bed pallet fell back down and locked itself above.
"There. Isn't this much nicer?"
"Yeah."
Locke ran one hand down the floorless surface of one of the walls. The glass was noticeably cooler than the air.
"It's elder glass, isn't it?"
"Sure as hell isn't plaster."
Chains shooed Locke along the passage to the left, when it turned a corner. "The whole temple cellar is surrounded by the stuff, sealed in it. The temple above was actually built to settle into it, hundreds of years ago. There's not a break in it, as far as I can tell, except for one or two little tunnels that lead out to other interesting places. It's flood-tight, and never lets in a drop from below, even when the water's waist-deep in the streets, and it keeps out rats and roaches and suckle-spiders and all that crap, so long as we mind our comings and goings." The clatter of metal pans and the low giggle of the Sansa brothers reached them from around the corner just before they turned it, entering into a comfortably appointed kitchen with tall wooden cabinets and a long witchwood table, surrounded by high-backed chairs. Locke actually rubbed his eyes when he saw their black velvet cushions and the varnished gold leaf that gilded their every surface. Carlo and Galdo were working at a brick cooking shelf, shuffling pans and banging knives over a huge white alchemical hearth slab. Locke had seen smaller blocks of this stone, which gave off a smokeless heat when water was splashed atop it, but this one must have weighed as much as Father Chain's. As Locke watched, Carlo, Galdo, held a pan in the air and poured water from a glass pitcher onto the sizzling slab. The great uprush of steam carried a deep bouquet of sweet cooking smells, and Locke felt saliva spilling down the back of his mouth. In the air over the witchwood table, a striking chandelier blazed. Locke would, in later years, come to recognize it as an armillary sphere, fashioned from glass with an axis of solid gold. At its heart shone an alchemical globe with the white bronze light of the sun. Surrounding this were the concentric glass rings that marked the orbits and precessions of the world and all her celestial cousins, including the three moons. At the outermost edges were 100 dangling stars that looked like spatters of molten glass, somehow frozen at the very instant of their outward explosions. The light ran and glimmered and burned along every facet of the chandelier, yet there was something wrong about it. It was as if the elder glass ceilings and walls were somehow drawing the light out of the alchemical sun, leavening it, weakening it, redistributing it along the full length and breadth of all the elder glass in this uncanny cellar.
"Welcome to our real home, our little temple to the benefactor."
Chains tossed his bag of coins down on the table.
"Our patron has always sort of danced upon the notion that austerity and piety go hand in hand. Down here, we show our appreciation for things by appreciating, if you get me. Boys, look who survived his interview."
"We never doubted," said one twin.
"For even a second," said the other.
"But now can we hear what he did to get himself kicked out of Shades Hill?"
The question, spoken in near perfect unison, had the ring of repeated ritual.
"When you're older."
Chains raised his eyebrows at Locke and shook his head, ensuring the boy could see the gesture clearly.
"Much older."
"Locke, I don't expect that you know how to set a table." When Locke shook his head, Chains led him over to a tall cabinet just to the left of the cooking hearth. Inside were stacks of white porcelain plates. Chains held one up so Locke could see the hand-painted heraldic design, a mailed fist clutching an arrow and a grapevine, and the bright gold gilding on the rim.
"Borrowed," said Chains, "on a rather permanent basis from Doña Isabella Manichezzo, the old dowager aunt of our own Duke Nicovante. She died childless and rarely gave parties, so it wasn't as though she was using them all. You see how some of our acts that might seem purely cruel and larcenous to outsiders are actually sort of convenient, if you look at them in the right way? That's the hand of the benefactor at work, or so we like to think. It's not as though we could tell the difference if he didn't want us to."
Chains handed the plate to Locke, who clutched at it with greatly exaggerated care and peered very closely at the gold rim and ran his right hand lovingly over the surface of the witchwood table.
"Now this used to be the property of Marius Cordo, a master merchant of Tal Verar. He had it in the great cabin of a triple-decker galley. Huge! 86 oars! I was a bit upset with him, so I lifted it, his chairs, his carpets and tapestries, and all of his clothes, right off the ship. I left his money. I was making a point. I dumped everything but the table into the sea of brass." "And that,"
Chains lifted a finger in the direction of the celestial chandelier,
That was being shipped overland from Ashmir in a guarded wagon convoy for the old Don Leviana. Somehow, in transit, it transformed itself into a box of straw. Chains took 3 more plates out of the cabinet and set them in Locke's arms. Damn, I was fairly good back when I actually worked for a living. Urk, said Locke, under the weight of the fine dinnerware. Oh, yeah. Chains gestured to the chair at the head of the table. Put one there for me. One for yourself on my left. 2 for Carlo and Galdo on my right. If you were my servant, what I'd tell you to lay out is a casual setting. Can you say that for me?
A casual setting.
Right. This is how the high and mighty eat when it's just close blood and maybe a friend or two. Chains let the set of his eyes and the tone of his voice suggest that he expected this lesson to be retained, and he began to introduce Locke to the intricacies of glasses, linen napkins, and silver eating utensils.
What kind of knife is this?
Locke held a rounded buttering utensil up for Chains' inspection.
It's all wrong. You couldn't kill anyone with this.
Well, not very easily, I'll grant you that, my boy. Chains guided Locke in the placement of the butter knife and assorted small dishes and bowls. But when the quality get together to dine, it's impolite to knock anybody off with anything but poison. That thing is for scooping butter, not slicing windpipes.
This is a lot of trouble to go to just to eat.
Well, in Shades Hill, you may be able to eat cold bacon and dirt pies off one another's asses for all your old master cares, but now you're a gentleman bastard. Emphasis on the gentleman. You're going to learn how to eat like this and how to serve people who eat like this.
Why?
Because, Locke Lamora, someday you're going to dine with barons and counts and dukes. You're going to dine with merchants and admirals and generals and ladies of every sort. And when you do... Chains put 2 fingers under Locke's chin and tilted the boy's head up so they were eye to eye. When you do, those poor idiots won't have any idea that they're really dining with a thief. 3. Now, isn't this lovely? Chains raised an empty glass and saluted his 3 young wards at the splendidly furnished table. Steaming brass bowls and heavy crockware held the results of Carlo and Galdo's efforts at the cooking hearth. Locke, seated on an extra cushion to raise his elbows just above the tabletop, stared at the food and the furnishings with wide eyes. He was bewildered at how quickly he had escaped his old life and fallen into this new one with strangely pleasant, crazy people. Chains lifted a bottle of something he'd called alchemical wine. The stuff was viscous and dark, like quicksilver. When he pulled the loosened cork, the air was filled with the scent of juniper. For a brief moment, it overwhelmed the spicy aroma of the main dishes. Chains poured a good measure of the stuff into the empty glass, and in the bright light it ran like molten silver. Chains raised the glass to a level with his eyes. A glass poured to air for the one who sits with us unseen, the patron and protector, the crooked warden, the father of necessary pretexts.
Thanks for deep pockets poorly guarded, said the Sansa brothers in unison, and Locke was caught off guard by the seriousness of their intonation.
Thanks for watchmen asleep at their posts, said Chains.
Thanks for the city to nurture us and the night to hide us, was the response.
Thanks for friends to help spend the loot. Chains brought the half-filled glass down and set it in the middle of the table. He took up another smaller glass. Into this he poured just a finger of the liquid silver. A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabitha well and pray for her safe return.
"Maybe we could have her back a little less crazy, though," said one of the Sansas,
whom Locke mentally labelled Carlo for convenience.
"And humble,"
Galdo nodded after he'd said this.
"Humble would be really great."
The brothers Sansa wish Sabatha well. Chains held the little glass of liquor rock steady and eyed the twins. "And they pray for her safe return."
"Yes, wish her well. Safe return, that would be really great."
"Who's Sabatha?" Locke spoke quietly, directing his inquiry to Chains. "An ornament to our little gang. Our only young woman, currently away on educational business." Chains set her glass down beside the one poured to the benefactor and plucked up Locke's glass in exchange. "Another special deal from your old master. Gifted, my boy, gifted like you are with a preternatural talent for the vexation of others."
"That's us he's talking about," said Carlo. "Pretty soon it'll mean you too,"
Galdo smiled. "Pipe down, twitlings." Chains poured a splash of the quicksilver wine into Locke's glass and handed it back to him. "One more toast and prayer. To Locke Lamora, our new brother, my new Pezon. We wish him well. We welcome him warmly. And for him, we pray, wisdom." With graceful motions, he poured wine for Carlo and Galdo, and then a nearly full glass for himself. Chains and the Sansas raised their glasses. Locke quickly copied them. Silver sparkled under gold. "Welcome to the gentlemen bastards." Chains tapped his glass gently against Locke's, producing a ringing sound that hung in the air before fading sweetly.
"You should have picked death," said Galdo. "He did offer you death as a choice, right?"
Carlo spoke as he and his brother tapped their own glasses together, then reached across the table in unison to touch Locke's. "Laugh it up, boys." Soon all the knocking about with glasses was finished, and Chains led the way with a quick sip of his wine. "Ah, mark my words, if this poor little creature lives a year, you two will be his dancing monkeys. He'll throw you grapes whenever he wants to see a trick. Go ahead and have a drink, Locke." Locke raised the glass. The silvery surface showed him a vivid but wobbly reflection of his own face and the brightly lit room around him. The wine's bouquet was a haze of juniper and anise that tickled his nose. He put the tiny image of himself to his lips and drank. The slightly cool liquor seemed to go two ways at once as he swallowed. A line of tickling warmth ran straight down his throat, while icy tendrils reached upward, sliding across the roof of his mouth and into his sinuses. His eyes bulged. He coughed and ran a hand over his suddenly numb lips. "It's mirror wine from Tal Verar. Good stuff. Now go ahead and eat something, or it'll pop your skull open." Carlo and Galdo whisked damp cloths off serving platters and bowls, revealing the full extent of the meal for the first time. There were indeed sausages, neatly sliced and fried in oil with quartered pears. There were also split red peppers stuffed with almond paste and spinach, dumplings of thin bread folded over chicken, fried until the bread was as translucent as paper, and cold black beans in wine and mustard sauce. The Sansa brothers were suddenly scooping portions of this and that onto Locke's plate, too fast for him to track. Working awkwardly with a two-pronged silver fork and one of the rounded knives he'd previously scorned, Locke began to shovel things into his mouth. The flavors seemed to burst gloriously, haphazardly. The chicken dumplings were spiced with ginger and ground orange peels. The wine sauce in the bean salad warmed his tongue. The sharp fumes of mustard burned his throat. He found himself gulping wine to put out each new fire as it arose. To his surprise, the Sansa twins didn't partake once they'd served him. They sat with their hands folded, watching Chains. When the older man seemed assured that Locke was eating, he turned to Carlo. "You're a Vardran noble. Let's say you're a liege graf from one of the less important Marrows.
You're at a dinner party in Tal Verar. An equal number of men and women with assigned seating. The party is just entering the dining hall. Your assigned lady is beside you as you enter, conversing with you. What do you do?
At a Vajran dinner party, I would hold her chair out for her without invitation.
Carlo didn't smile.
But Ferrari ladies will stand beside a chair to show they want it pulled out. It's impolite to presume, so I'd let her make the first move.
Very good. Now. Chains pointed to the second Sansa with one hand as he began adding food to his plate with the other. What's 17 multiplied by 19? Galdo closed his eyes in concentration for a few seconds.
323.
Correct. What's the difference between a Vajran Nautical League and a Therin Nautical League?
The Vajran League is 150 yards longer.
Very good. That's that, then. Go and eat. As the Sansa brothers began to undecorously struggle for possession of certain serving dishes, Chains turned to Locke, whose plate was already half empty. After you've been here a few days, I'm going to start asking questions about what you've learned, too. If you want to eat, you'll be expected to learn.
What am I going to learn, other than setting tables?
Everything! Chains looked very pleased with himself. Everything, my boy. How to fight, how to steal, how to lie with a straight face, how to cook meals like this, how to disguise yourself, how to speak like a noble, how to scribe like a priest, how to skulk like a half-wit.
Carlo already knows that one, said Galdo.
Agmo agnamabra,
said Carlo around a mouthful of food. Remember what I said when I told you we didn't work like other thieves work? We're a new sort of thief here, Locke. What we are is actors, false facers. I sit here and pretend to be a priest of Perelandro. For years now, people have been throwing money at me. How do you think I paid to furnish this little fairy burrow, this food? I'm 53. Nobody my age can steal around rooftops and charm locks. I'm better paid for being blind than I ever was for being quick and clever. And now I'm too slow and too round to pass for anything really interesting. Chains finished off the contents of his glass and poured another. But you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha, you four will have every advantage I didn't. Your education will be thorough and vigorous. I'll refine my notions, my techniques. When I'm finished, the things you four will pull, well, they'll make my little scam with this temple look simple and unambitious.
That sounds nice, said Locke,
who was feeling the wine. A warm haze of charitable contentment was descending over him and smothering the tension and worry that was so second nature to a Shades Hill orphan.
What do we do first?
Well, tonight, if you're not busy throwing up the first decent meal you've ever had, Carlo and Galdo will draw you a bath. Once you're less aromatic company, you can sleep in. Tomorrow, we'll get you an acolyte's robe, and you can sit the steps with us, taking coins. Tomorrow night, Chains scratched at his beard while he took a sip from his glass, I take you to meet the big man, Kappa Barsavi. He's ever so curious to get a look at you. Chapter 3 Imaginary Men 1 For the second time in 2 days, Don Lorenzo Salvara found his life interrupted by masked and hooded strangers in an unexpected place. This time it was just after midnight, and they were waiting for him in his study.
"Close the door,"
said the shorter intruder. His voice was all Camor, rough and smoky, and clearly accustomed to being obeyed.
"Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
"Who the hell are you?"
Salvara's sword hand curled reflexively. His belt held no scabbard. He slid the door closed behind him, but made no move to sit at his writing desk.
"How did you get in here?"
The intruder who'd first spoken reached up and pulled down the black cloth that covered his nose and mouth. His face was lean and angular, his hair black, his dark moustache thin and immaculately trimmed. A white scar arced across the man's right cheekbone. He reached into the folds of his well-cut black cloak and pulled out a black leather wallet, which he flipped open so the Don could see its contents, a small crest of gold set inside an intricate design of frosted glass.
"Gods!"
Don Salvara fell into his chair nervously, without further hesitation. "You're Midnighters!"
"Just so."
The man folded his wallet and put it back in his cloak. The silent intruder, still masked and hooded, moved casually around to stand just a few feet behind Don Lorenzo, between him and the door.
"We apologize for the intrusion, but our business here is extremely sensitive."
Have I somehow offended his grace?"
"Not to my knowledge, my Lord Salvara. In fact, you might say we're here to help prevent you from doing so."
What did you say you did to Conte?"
"Just gave him a little something to help him sleep. We know he's loyal, and we know he's dangerous. We didn't want any misunderstandings."
The man standing at the door punctuated this statement by stepping forward, reaching around Don Salvara and gently setting Conte's matching fighting knives down on the desktop.
"I see. I trust that he'll be well."
Don Salvara drummed his fingers on his writing desk and stared at the scarred intruder.
"I should be very displeased otherwise."
"He is completely unharmed. I give you my word as the Duke's man."
"I shall hold that sufficient, for the time being."
The scarred man sighed and rubbed his eyes with two gloved fingers.
"There's no need for us to begin like this, my lord. I apologize for the abruptness of our appearance and the manner of our intrusion, but I believe you'll find that your welfare is paramount in our master's eyes. I'm instructed to ask, did you enjoy yourself at the revel today?"
"Yes."
Don Salvara spoke carefully, as though to a solicitor or a court recorder. "I suppose that would be an accurate assessment."
"Good, good. You had company, didn't you?"
"The Doña Sofia was with me."
"I refer to someone else, not one of his grace's subjects, not Camori."
"Ah, the merchant. A merchant named Lucas Fairwhite from Emberlane."
"From Emberlane, of course."
The scarred man folded his arms and looked around the Don's study. He stared for a moment at a pair of small glass portraits of the old Don and Doña Salvara, set in a frame decked with black velvet funeral ribbons.
"Well, that man is no more a merchant of Emberlane than you or I, my Lord Salvara. He's a fraud, a sham."
Don
Salvara nearly jumped to his feet, but remembered the man standing behind him and seemed to think better of it.
"I don't see how that could be possible. He—"
"Beg pardon, my lord."
The scarred man smiled, gruesomely and artificially, as a man without children might smile when trying to comfort an upset babe.
"But let me ask you, have you ever heard of the man they call the Thorn of Camor?"
"Two. I only steal because my dear old family needs the money to live."
Locke Lamora made this proclamation with his wineglass held high. He and the other gentleman bastards were seated at the old witchwood table in the opulent burrow beneath the house of Perelandro. Carlo and Galdo on his right, Jean and Bug on his left. A huge spread of food was set before them, and the celestial chandelier swung overhead with its